Artificial intelligence has moved from the edges of the industry into the core of how music is actually made. Not hypothetically, not someday, right now. Songs are being generated from text prompts, voices are being cloned, stems can be separated instantly. Entire workflows that used to take hours or days are now happening in minutes or seconds. And yet, for all of that change, there's still a surprising lack of clarity around what's really going on. Every generation of musicians has said the same thing when a new tool arrives. This will change everything. The electric guitar, the synthesizer, Pro Tools, the drum machine, Auto-Tune. And they were right. Those tools did change how music gets made. But there's something different about what's happening right now with AI. Some people say AI is just the next tool in that line. A more powerful one, sure, but fundamentally the same. A tool that musicians will learn, master, and use to make better music. Other people say no, this is different. This isn't a tool that extends what a musician can do. This is a tool that replaces what a musician does. And the implications ripple through everything. Copyright, royalties, what it means to be an artist, who owns creativity. And then there's a third camp that says both things are happening at the same time. It's a tool and a threat, liberating and destabilizing. This is the first episode of a three-part series on AI and music, and we're starting here, at this exact fork in the road. Not pretending the answer is obvious, because it's not. I'm Larry Miller from the NYU Stony Audio Institute and the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt. My co-host for the series is Sherry Hu, founder of Water and Music, a research and intelligence firm that tracks AI music tools in over 1,000 music tech companies. She's a Harvard-trained statistician, former Juilliard piano student, and a journalist whose work has appeared in Billboard, Forbes, Rolling Stone, NPR, and pretty much every place. Sherry also teaches in the NYU Steinhardt Music Business Program. Sherry, welcome.
Thank you so much, Larry. Thank you for having me.
And our guest is Young Spielberg, a Grammy Award-winning producer, songwriter, and AI analyst at Water and Music. Young Spielberg has been doing something rare, actually integrating these tools into serious professional work, not just talking about them. Young Spielberg, glad you're here.
Glad to be here. And we'll talk about it, but it's not so rare, actually, at this point.
Well, let's start with a simple but important question. And I want one sentence from each of you before we dig in. In one sentence, what's changed most in the last 18 months? Sherry?
I will give a sentence fragment. The scale and the stakes, I think.
The scale and the stakes.
Yeah.
Can you say more about that?
Yes. In terms of, so as part of preparing for this podcast, I actually looked back to like what has changed about the technology, not just in the last 18 months, but in the last like several decades. Like when did AI music start as a concept? And then what is truly unique about this moment? I think what's really interesting is that the creative concept of outsourcing musical decisions to some external machine is almost 80 years old. I think I think a lot of music history will trace that back, or a lot of historians will trace that back to composers like John Cage. He famously experimented with this concept of chance music. I think in his case, he used this Chinese text called the I Ching. Like, what happens if I take my taste out of the equation and outsource all the notes that are written on this piece of sheet music to this outside text that's not my brain? I think also artists like Brian Eno really helped popularize this more in the concept of, or in the context of tape music, ambient music more broadly. So I think what is truly unique about today, to go back to the scale and the stakes. I think what's truly unique about these AI music models that are really popular right now is that they operate on a scale that is orders of magnitude more than those examples that I gave, where they literally are trained on the history of recorded music. I think it's totally appropriate to frame it that way, anywhere from hundreds of thousands to millions, even tens of millions of tracks over the course of recorded music history. So if you want to like emulate any specific style, any specific genre, whatever you can dream, I think that's at least the promise of these models. And then the other huge difference, this is more about the stakes, especially commercially, is that these models, they have the ambition to and are already plugged directly into the commercial music market. We're seeing, you know, these AI songs directly competing with pre-AI tracks on streaming services like Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, which we'll get into a lot of stats around what that looks like. A lot of AI music like passes through traditional distribution platforms with no problem. So so to wrap that up, the scale and the stakes. The tech has improved a lot and is learning from so much more than maybe the early experiments that we saw with this concept of outsourcing music creativity to technology. And then it is directly competing in the market, arguably, with pre-AI, you know, human-made tracks.
Young Spielberg, what about you? What's changed the most in the last 18 months?
Through my lens as an analyst in the work I do at Water and Music, the velocity of new entrants into the market, creating new creator tools, has slowed way down. And we're seeing a consolidation. There have been a number of acquisitions this year, which was not even true in 2025. And I think there's four or five already in 2026. Where we are seeing a lot of new entrants is in the infrastructure layer around AI detection and attribution. That's a huge change. When we first started tracking these tools years ago, there were dozens, if not more, new tools, even companies spinning up every quarter, releasing new tools. And then through my lens for the professional work I do, I say, you know, parallel to my analyst work, but in the studio, the number of people who now have not heard of Suno is extremely de minimis. Whereas 18 months ago, a lot of people, it wasn't uncommon for me to go into a studio and ask someone if they heard of Suno and, oh, what's that? And people still discovering it. But, you know, they've got 2 million paid users now, and that's nearly double some of like the biggest creator platforms in the world. So I think they're reaching a certain mass of, you know, penetration.
So a critical mass in the production platforms, and also a great deal of change in the distribution layer. And we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But first, if we can rewind just back to 2021 or so, what did AI in music actually mean in, let's say, 2021? What were people thinking about it or misunderstanding about it?
I can start with this one. Actually, I have a question for you. Is there any reason why you chose this year in particular, as opposed to, say, 2016, 2020?
Fake Drake.
That came out 2021?
Ish.
Okay. So I can talk through how I lay out this history.
Okay.
ChatGPT.
Let me reframe the question then. Sherry, how do you think about the modern history of music and AI?
Yes. So I think to go back to my earlier comments, going back, like, I guess, much further in history to composers like John Cage or kind of the first larger scale Brian Eno albums and bodies of work. AI music as a modern phenomenon is also not entirely new. If you look at bigger tech companies like Google, who have been building out AI music, AI machine learning for music research labs for a really long time, they have been active in this market for at least, if not more than a decade. So in 2016, they launched what has since become one of the more popular open source AI and ML music set of tools called Magento. And if you look at the tools that were launching back then, it very much was not generative at all. It was part of a paradigm that the lines are blurring a little bit, but I think we could call them more assistive AI, where as opposed to generating a wholly new output, the user, the artist, composer, producer, give the tool an input, like give the tool a song or like an audio snippet, and then it will manipulate or transform the audio in a way that you would want. So this is where I think for a very long time, outside of Google, also companies like iZotope have been building AI and ML powered plugins for mixing, mastering, and production in this very assistive way. So that area is not entirely new at all.
So just to put a fine point on that, for years, a couple of decades anyway, we have had tools to clean up old or scratchy sounding music, to restore things, for example, long before AI and music became the most important and popular theme at every music conference in the world.
Yes, correct. And then even within the generative music sphere, I think a very, very important technical point is to ask the question of what exactly is being generated. So, for example, a very common, a very helpful distinction to make, I think, especially with the modern era of AI music, is between MIDI generation and pure audio synthesis, where you are creating a whole waveform from scratch. I think MIDI generation has been around for much longer than maybe people think. I think even some of the early Magenta tools, or kind of 2016 to 2020, 2021 or so era of AI music tools, have allowed producers to generate. And also, just to clarify, these are not MIDI generations of entire songs. These are generations of maybe like 8-bar loops or samples or clips that you can incorporate into your track. So it still leaves a lot of the creative responsibility on a longer structural scale on the producer or on the artist. I think what is definitely unique about the Sunos and Udios of the world is that they are generating, you know, wholly new waveforms, not just MIDI files. I think you can technically extract MIDI now from Suno outputs, but, you know, at their core, they are still generating wholly new waveforms. And the length of the generation keeps on extending, I think, as these models learn more and more patterns, again, from the history of recorded music, about what good song structure looks like, what good melody and harmony looks like over the course of a song. And so, whereas I think when Suno and Udio first launched, generations were very much limited to just 15 to 30 seconds. Now I think the default is at least a few minutes, like 2 to 3 minutes, so what we would normally expect for a song. So the nature of the generation is changing, and the length is changing, which is allowing these outputs to live convincingly on streaming services and in the commercial market.
Young Spielberg, when did this shift for you personally from, wow, this is an interesting tool, to something that you actually rely on?
Before I go to that, I think you might find that 2021 has an interesting year of history for water and music as well, because we had just come out of a couple of big research projects, very decentralized. We had 50 or 60 people working on them at a time. And we're trying to decide what was the most important thing to look at next. And DALL-E 2 came out. I think that was the model at the time. And I personally felt this is going to come for music. I wasn't sure how, but I thought we got to go look at this. And we flew to Berlin and we met with Matt Dreihurst, who is Holly Herndon's partner. And as far as I know, Nostradamus, and I will probably refer to him no less than 5 to 10 times during this conversation. And he explained to us that they had it. Who was they? The big tech companies, they had it. You could dream of a song, anything you want, you could type it in, you can get it. And I kind of nodded along, taking notes, and I was like, yeah, sure, sure. Especially someone who spent my whole entire professional career writing music, it was a pretty confronting thing to think about. And honestly, I didn't take it particularly seriously at the time, but he was totally right. And there's a few other things he was very right about, which we'll talk about later on. But so 2021, Larry, was this, you know, Mecca to Berlin, where we were read from the scrolls, and so it was told.
What, since then, since 2021, what moved faster than expected?
I think that the ability to get a piece of the ability to generate a recording that is unrecognizable in terms of whether or not the ability to generate a recording that is indistinguishable between something generated from one of these models and a human being played, that really surprised me. And I think that came way earlier than people thought. Yes, there are certain things like some high frequency artifacts, and if you have a very, very trained ear, but sometimes you just can't tell. I mean, it doesn't matter how trained your ear is, especially if you're generating something that's supposed to be lo-fi, you know, like a 60s soul track. And of course, a lot of this music has become some of the most popular music generated by these models, and I don't think that's a coincidence. So I think that in particular, which also I think has the biggest impacts and the biggest ripples across the industry, you know, move faster than we anticipated.
Sherry, your thoughts?
Yes, just to double down on one thing that young Spielberg said, AI music has passed the Turing test. I think any conversation that happens about, especially commercially, what's going to happen should assume that the distinction between the two is like nearing zero. And then one conversation I remember from that meeting with Matt Dreihurst in Berlin that I think is also true as technology continues to improve is that it's always helpful to assume that your wildest dreams about the tech are true. I think probably within the next like 6 to 12 months, the way that these models are improving, the way that in many cases, AI is helping to build the next generation of AI. Like, assume that is true and have any kind of, you know, commercial scenario planning, discussion, debate from there. I think that's very helpful, if not daunting at the same time.
What, if anything, has moved slower than expected?
I think this actually is directly tied to the history question and especially to this like 2021 ballpark window, because I think ChatGPT launched 2022, I think later that year. And I very clearly remember the first time that I tried ChatGPT was just in a cafe somewhere. And I was very mind blown by like what was possible. And I, similarly to what Young was saying, I was thinking about, you know, like what this could mean for music. And I think it still took like 2 to 3 years for music models to have its ChatGPT moment, as some people have called it. After kind of learning more about the landscape, we've learned that there are actually very technical reasons why music is a harder creative domain to try to translate to AI, not just because of the, I guess, the creative or philosophical elements of like, how do you mimic the life of a human artist, you know, poured into this songwriting or this production. It's also just because music is a temporal format. Like, it evolves across time, as opposed to if you think about a piece of text or an image just on the page. So for an AI model, it's a lot more, it's a lot easier to kind of deal with and predict what's going to come next for those domains. That was surprising to me, but I've since learned that there is a very, you know, concrete technical reason why music. So also, I guess, a music history element. Music has historically been the canary in the coal mine, I think, for a lot of emerging tech trends. Like it was the first use case for a lot of internet forums to just like talk about, you know, among music fans, what they liked. For smart speakers, music was like very quickly a top two, top three use case. AI is actually a very rare case where, especially from modern music's perspective, we'd have to look outside music to understand where it's going. Music is actually lagging behind what's happening with large language models, what's happening with image generators like DALL-E as well. So that's been a very interesting like mental model shift for us.
So let's build a map. I want to think about this as a stack. Creation, production, distribution, monetization. Let's start with Sherry. How would you describe the AI music stack today, and where is it indispensable versus still experimental?
When thinking about this question, I think back to, this was probably around when the iPhone first launched and the App Store first launched, the phrase was, there's an app for that. No matter what you dreamed of wanting to do, there was an app that allowed you to do that. I think putting the same lens on AI is actually very helpful, because just AI as a technology and its impact on society is so broad-ranging and so foundational that at any part of the value chain, I think AI will have some kind of impact. So if we go through all the steps that you laid out, so AI creation, we already covered a lot of ground on that already in this conversation. Again, I would differentiate between, in terms of like technically what's happening, between assistive AI, which is bounded by the input that you give it, like audio-wise. So stem separation, mixing, mastering, upscaling, which I guess on a meta level is very useful for things like podcasts as well. Like all of those different tasks that transform existing audio kind of falls under assistive. And then you have generative tools that are not bound by an audio input. They are creating it themselves. They are, you know, deciding and laying out how what the music actually is. I think what's interesting and what's driven a lot of our research recently in modern music is that those two areas are blurring together increasingly. For example, Suno, they started out as just a text-to-music platform, but I think still what a lot of people are not aware of is that they have a full-fledged browser-based digital audio workstation, or DAW, within their app now. I think they just recently were hiring ahead of studio sessions and songwriting camps, and they want to bring this tool into very professional, well-trained circles just to see how this generative technology could help drive a lot of those traditional songwriting processes. So I think we'll see, as there's this kind of commercial pressure for a lot of these AI platforms to house or to keep people engaged and to keep people on their platform specifically for as long as possible, the tasks are also going to blur. And I think the Sunos of the world want to become the kind of everything platform. The area of distribution and monetization is actually where a lot is still being figured out. And we can go more in depth in a bit into like technically why it's so difficult. But I think what's interesting about that part of the stack is that traditional or incumbent non-AI platforms still have huge influence. For example, Suno, their leadership has talked very publicly about wanting to become a consumer entertainment destination. And I think that's driven a lot of the discovery and recommendation features that they've built on their own platform for fully Suno tracks. At the same time, the vast majority, at least, of industry attention and also ambition for these creators is to have wider commercial impact. And so where do you go? You still need to go through a DistroKid. You still need to go through a traditional distributor to get onto where the hundreds of millions of subscribers globally are listening, which are, again, Spotify, Apple Music. YouTube is a huge, huge distribution platform for AI music these days. So in the meantime, as all of this is being figured out, the channels for distribution and monetization are actually pretty standard from what we're used to. One really emerging area, for sure, especially with all these licensing deals that are happening, is how do you take AI platform revenue and distribute it to human artists? So I think the argument that especially a lot of artists and labels are making and publishers is that if the Sunos and Udios of the world are trained on the history of recorded music, that is not fair use and there is some money that should be paid back to the original creators. How exactly that's going to work is still something that everybody's still figuring out, even as these licensing deals and settlements are being done. So in terms of compensation, that's like a very much an emerging area. But in the meantime, these AI songs are living on all the channels that we're familiar with and earning royalties in a very traditional way that we're all familiar with.
I would actually, from all of that, which I agree with, I think is a great outline, I would push back on the concept of indispensable, Larry. And I think for me and many of my peers, AI is not indispensable to making music. I mean, for the last 30 years of our lives, we made music just fine without AI. We supported ourselves and careers, you know, making music. But of course, there are some tools that we feel are incredible and adds so much value to what we do. You know, when amp simulators got really good and you no longer needed to record a guitar amp live to have a really convincing guitar sound inside of your DAW, that was really critical. And I think for some creators, these AI tools are approaching that level of importance in their workflow. For others who, let's say, people who just write lyrics and then are using Suno to create their songs, it is indispensable. Like they don't have anything without that unless they can go find a creative partner, producer, musician, and they're going to have to essentially put together a band like people did forever. No value judgment on that. But just saying, you know, depending on where your skill set lies, these tools are more or less, you know, more or less indispensable to the process.
How widespread do you think use of the various AI creation tools is in the modern songwriting process?
Well, there are 2 million paid subscribers. And to the best of our knowledge, that is more than double, almost triple what we know some of the biggest platforms are, where producers and writers are having paid subscriptions, you know, to different things to help them do what they have to do. So I would say that's pretty widespread. Of course, that also, I think we also infer that it's gone beyond just producers, and there's this new class of consumer creator. And, you know, we can go into this, but one of the big selling points that Suno and a lot of other companies that were making generative audio products were selling is this is going to bring more people into the fold. And our understanding from conversations with different companies and research we've done is that this is happening. There are more people using DAWs and bringing generative audio into DAWs. And for the time being, you know, this hypothesis is playing out, I would say, in their favor in terms of a positive impact on increasing the amount of people experimenting and playing with music. What's going to happen to the professional class on the back of this is yet to be seen. But, you know,
that raises such an important question. And so I have to ask, is AI making more musicians or just more content?
Right now, I believe it is making more musicians. And I think if you have to delineate between hobbyist and professional, I think if you're going to look over time. So I feel very confident that it will make more hobbyist musicians over time. And right now, that is what we're observing, with the research that we've done and conversations we've had. Whether or not it is going to hollow out the middle class, which is a phrase that gets used a lot in so many different sectors of, all kinds of business around the world. That's yet to be seen, but I think there's a very, very real chance that will happen. And I will say, since I started 20 years ago, the middle class has also been, you know, totally deteriorating. I would say, you know, I entered the music industry right at the beginning of downloads, and when we were unbundling from albums. And it was not lost on me that the songwriting credits that I was getting at that time, I probably, you know, could have retired my children's children's children, because they were a part of huge records, but not being bought altogether in the same package like they were before.
Sure.
So I think, competing for human attention, again, was also a problem that we were already at max saturation. This is a continuing trend that I definitely worry about. And I know a lot of my peers have adapted in different ways over the years, in terms of making it work as a career.
Sherry, your thoughts?
One aspect that's always very difficult to avoid about any AI conversations is that once you go deep enough in the debate, you end up at what is the meaning of life? Like, what is this all for? Why are we humans brought onto this earth. And I think the music industry microcosm of that is what does it mean to be an artist? You know, at what is the threshold after which you are a musician? So like when I, that's the first thing I thought of when you asked that question, like, is AI making more musicians? It absolutely is changing the threshold in a way that I think maybe many people are not comfortable with. The example I always love to talk about is my dad used Suno to make a theme song bilingual in Chinese and English for his run club and just like posted it in his WeChat group and everyone made, you know, everyone had a lot of fun with it. I would argue he's a musician if he keeps like, you know, experimenting with Suno and like making these songs and expressing himself. I guess I would take a more generous view on that than maybe a lot of people, especially on the industry side, especially from more legacy models of recording and production and creation. So I think it is both making more musicians, if you're willing to, I guess, widen the aperture on like what a musician is and how we define that, which is a, for sure a philosophical question. And then it is making a lot more content. I think one stat that I'm still trying to wrap my head around comes from Deezer, which has been the most transparent streaming service, I think, in reporting on the number of tracks that are being uploaded that are AI generated to their platform. They also have a very long running research team that's been building their own AI detection technologies. The latest stat is there are 60,000 AI-generated tracks that are uploaded to their platform every single day, which in a matter of just a year is approaching half of all the uploads on their platform. Just to give you a sense of the growth that's happening in terms of supply, I think those tracks are still importantly accounting for a very small minority of actual consumption. They've talked about how a lot of those streams are actually fraudulent. So it's like bots listening to bots. There's a little like bot society happening right alongside humans. So consumption still has a long way to go, but supply is absolutely creating a ton of pressure on distributors and streaming services in terms of just more content being out there.
You mentioned Deezer, and they have been public about disclosing the number of daily AI uploads that they're receiving. Do we have any reason to believe that the scale or the number of daily AI-generated uploads is different on Spotify or the other services?
Even though Deezer's market share is smaller, we can definitely assume that the percentages are similar to the other platforms, especially because the number of tracks uploaded, I feel like it's hovering at between 100,000 to 120,000 these days across all DSPs. The huge difference is what you do with that information. So from the streaming services perspective, Deezer, I think also because they have less market share, they actually have much more wiggle room to experiment and to take a bold stance as a platform. So they have their own in-house AI detection technology and have taken the stance that the platform is the primary party responsible for flagging and dealing with AI tracks. So they apply their own AI label automatically on tracks that they flag as AI generated, and then they actually deprioritize those tracks from algorithmic recommendations as well. So also taking a stance on, you know, what music is worthy of our users' time. I think it's a very interesting position to take. In contrast, Spotify and Apple Music, Apple most recently with this initiative that they call transparency tags, put responsibility on the uploader to disclose. So Apple Music, they now have these metadata tags, I think, for not just the recording, but also the composition and the album artwork and the music video. They say that, you know, you, the uploader, need to disclose which aspects of your work that you're uploading to our service are AI generated or not. Neither approach is fully perfect. I think having a platform fully dictate whether a song is labeled AI or not, with like not super 100% transparent path for recourse, like if you want to debate that, there's definitely trade-offs with that. And then of course, a platform being very hands-off and saying like, we're not gonna do anything, at least not yet. Like you, the label, you, the artist are responsible. Of course, there's a lot of critique about that as well.
Most people who think at all about AI and music, or might be concerned about all of the use that is happening on the creation side, or just reading the headlines, have certainly heard about, if not used, the major creation platforms, Suno and Udio. How should we think about them? What are each of them best at today?
I think the interesting thing is when they first both emerged, my personal evaluation was that the quality of Udio was better. And I think that was something that we saw a lot in the water and music forums of people that were experimenting with these tools. But the engineering resource and the product velocity of Suno has just been ferocious. And Udio really was number two, and I think had no choice but to make the licensing deals that it made, and now will, of course, be a not an open platform, but a
walled garden.
Thank you. Yeah. A walled garden where everything that gets made on the platform has to stay on the platform. And this is going to be a completely different experience for the users. And I think for many of their users, we're very vocal, completely ruin the experience because people want to take their music and share it. And of course, this is the argument from rights holders, which is this music is, in fact, leaving the walled gardens and going out and competing in the open arena for attention with music that was made not with AI tools. And Sherry just gave all the stats around that. So if I had to sum up a difference between Udio and Suno, of course, now it is Udio's fully licensed, but a closed garden experience, a walled garden experience. And I do think that the efficacy of the tool has lagged. They have not developed. I don't know if you're an F1 fan, but you have to develop the car throughout the year. You can start out with the best car, but if you don't have good development throughout the year, you're going to get left behind. And Suno, like I said, has just had ferocious development, both on the marketing and on the product side.
Young, can you just walk me through what's in your actual production stack? What tools are you using in order to accomplish maybe more efficiently certain production tasks that you used to do manually or that you never were able to do before?
I'd actually like to go on the other side of the fence from the efficiency conversation. And we will come to the efficiency, I promise. But I think we've talked a lot about the tools today that I use in the efficiency market. And I'm going to coin Yotam Mann, who works over at DeepMind. And he had a company called Never Before Heard Sounds. And one thing about diving into AI music for me personally, as somebody who not a technical person in the sense that I had any computer science background, I have found it completely reinvigorating as a space to try to create new sounds again with tools that I feel are largely unexplored and tools I can build myself in a way that I feel more inspired to. I mean, I could have always gone out to a junkyard and gotten pieces of pipe and soldered them together and make my own horn instruments, you know, which they did for the Dr. Seuss movie, but I didn't feel called to do that. And I've always been, you know, really into synthesizers and then, you know, making music with the computer specifically. And so a few tools specifically that I find really fun for sound design and that I use in my process that are not as well known. One of them is called the Combobulator, and this is built by Datamind. Which is a wonderful company. And what they've done is they've created a bunch of artist brains. So, for example, you would have Young Spielberg's bass sounds, and you create a model that is trained on a very specific timbre or a very specific part of a specific producer's process that they're known for. And what I can then do in real time is take something that I have sang, played, whatever it is, a piece of audio, play it through this brain. All the brain knows is young Spielberg's bass. So whatever you give it, it tries to make it a young Spielberg bass sound. And you have different, if you could think about it as a multidimensional space, all the different things I've trained it on young Spielberg's bass. Here are my distorted bass sounds and my round bass sounds and my soft and my loud. And it's multidimensional. And with this tool, you can actually explore those that space in real time. And I just think it's a radically enjoyable and interesting experience for sound design. And that's a tool that I think you're not going to see a lot of headlines about.
Great. Sherry, let me ask you about the infrastructure layer. Who's building the picks and shovels for the infrastructure, distribution, maybe monetization layer, rather than the generation platforms like Suno and Udio? Who's in that space?
It is definitely getting equally, if not even more crowded than the creation side. I think as Young was referencing earlier, which is super interesting because I think that's a good indicator of like what the priority question is right now in the industry, which is less how do we make this music and more how will the value exchange or value distribution actually happen. The way that we break it down is even, I guess, before talking about specific technologies or infrastructures, just getting clarity on what question you're actually trying to answer or what problem you're trying to solve. For example, is this AI or not is a very different kind of question and requires a very different kind of tech from what training data specifically may have influenced this output and therefore should get some kind of royalty check. So is this AI or not? That's the world of AI detection that powers like Deezer's kind of top-down platform-driven AI labeling. There is a whole cottage industry of like 15 to 20 different platforms that are trying to compete in this market now and sell to every stakeholder, like selling to streaming services, distributors, and even labels and rights holders. That technology is evolving in interesting ways because it no longer is a binary question, but more so is looking at which specific parts of the process may have used AI in some way. I think that definitely informed like the Apple transparency tags, distinguishing between recording and composition, but also like, were just the vocals in this track AI generated or not? So that world is definitely moving very quickly because I think it is also the lowest hanging fruit. Like, is this AI or not? And then we can kind of move pretty quickly on a policy decision around that.
And there's adoption and interest. Yeah. So I think you're just seeing market forces at play here where more and more companies are needing to identify AI music. And so more and more companies are spinning up to help them do that.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. And then on the opposite end, so the most critical, but also most complicated question is an area called attribution. I think this is part of wider field of AI research that can be called either interpretability or AI explainability, depending on the exact question that you're asking. But the overall meta motivation is trying to understand why a model acted in a certain way to get to this output. So I think the most relevant question in the music industry or for these AI music models is how do the model learn from all the training data that it trained on to get to the specific output? And can we build some kind of economic model around mapping that influence? I think that is the ideal optimistic gold standard for having some kind of royalty system around AI music outputs the way that we do with streaming or kind of with traditional consumption. The problem is that, or the challenge is that these models are trained on millions, tens of millions of songs. Again, the history of recorded music. And another very important technical component of how these larger scale foundational models learn. They typically are looking at all the training data and picking out concepts on one level abstracted from, let's take the bass from Young Spielberg's song and incorporate it, you know, into this track. Just because the corpus that they're learning from is so broad, they are picking up these concepts that sometimes can be difficult to attribute to a specific person. Like, who do we attribute the, I don't know, hopefully this will resonate with listeners, but like the 1-5-6-4 chord progression, like who do we attribute that to, right? It is used, recycled over and over again in so many different songs across genres. So that makes the question of attribution really tricky from a technical standpoint. And then it's also, I think, inherently a political issue as well, because if you have all these songs that do sound pretty similar or have pretty similar musical elements, who decides which of those songs might get ranked more highly in the attribution or like royalty system? And that is, I think, fundamentally a question of commercial power and influence over those decisions as well.
Well, it's only tricky if you're doing it by analyzing the outputs. It's not tricky if somebody actually interrogates what's happening inside the model, but this capability is not available at scale.
Yes. To go back to something that I mentioned earlier of AI being a rare case of music actually lagging behind, something that I am following a lot to just be up to date with attribution and explainable AI is what the biggest AI labs are doing. So especially Anthropic, which builds the Claude model. I think they are, because they care a lot about AI safety, I think they're investing millions and millions of dollars into this research. OpenAI to a certain extent as well. If they haven't figured it out, the music industry is not going to be able to figure it out. So until they have some kind of transferable framework for explainable AI, especially with these large models, I think, yeah, as Young said, we're very far from being able to interrogate the actual inner workings of an AI music model and understand how specific inputs translate to outputs. In the meantime, kind of what Young was referring to, a lot of attribution technologies are instead doing more like similarity search or embeddings around the outputs. So how that works is you take the AI output and you map it in what's called a latent space. So you can just imagine like a two-dimensional or three-dimensional space against all the inputs and see which inputs might be most similar across specific dimensions. Like you could look at just the composition or just the recording, you know, qualities. That is definitely easier, definitely cheaper, but for sure is imperfect because, yeah, it has nothing to do with how the model's actually working on the inside. So, yeah, this is all still being figured out. Hopefully, the bigger AI labs with much more funding can maybe figure something out. But in the meantime, the industry, the music industry, is leaning on these imperfect but definitely easier to understand techniques.
And so what we've been saying is attribution at this moment is not as much a technical question, but a political one. Do you think it's important to have some attribution system in place regardless of what the technical efficacy is, but get it in place now because you don't want things to run away and for us to basically lose what is the underpinning of how we've distributed value based upon IP, you know, for the last 100 years.
Sherry, where is value concentrating in the new landscape? Let me ask the question. Sherry, where is value concentrating in this new landscape? Creators, platforms, or rights holders?
As of this moment, for sure the platforms. And I'll kind of think out loud through this, but if we go through there are a few different angles to this. Young Spielberg looks after our AI music database. I think right now it is at over 300 different apps and tools and models. That is a lot. I think if you are a founder who is trying to scale an AI music tool, it's an extremely competitive environment. And I think we've seen, because of that commercial pressure, a lot of features have started to look the same. I published an article on this recently called The Collision Course. Like, this is also related to the assistive and generative sides kind of colliding. Like, everyone is trying to move towards being the everything platform for all things AI music, for all creators. Commercially, a natural end state of that is consolidation. And so I think as of recording this right now, this year, there have been more exits than fundraisers for AI music companies. This episode so far, they acquired actually an early Suno competitor that used to be called Refusion, is now called Producer AI. That is kind of folded into Google's suite of AI creative tools. Splice is trying to also become the everything platform for producers in its own way. And they acquired a voice AI platform called Kits. BeatStars acquired a more MIDI focused generation platform catering to producers called Lemonade. So within platforms, power for sure is increasingly concentrating at the top. Suno has, I think, 300 million ARR, or like annual run rate. So like an estimate of its annual revenue. I don't think there's really any independent AI music platform that matches that. So I think in terms of like capital and power concentration within tech companies is going to be a very, very, I think the head, the top like 3-5 or so platforms are really going to pull ahead. I think we're kind of seeing this with OpenAI, which just raised over $100 billion in funding, which is crazy. Like I cannot even start to wrap my head around, you know, how much money that is, but like that is how much the leaders in the AI platform world are really pulling ahead, and also just how much capital they need to keep their models running. So I think we'll definitely see that within music. So in terms of value across the rest of the music ecosystem, I do think it's interesting that the major labels have been the loudest in terms of licensing deals. So I think in terms of how the monetization and compensation models around like Suno and Udio will look, they will absolutely have more influence over that. They already have, by distribution ownership, they already control like 80% of the music market. So that I'm definitely like on the edge of my seat for that. Like, is that going to translate over to how value is distributed from these AI platforms? Especially because these attribution systems are still being figured out. This has been a big critique from artists. Like, Suno's generating hundreds of millions of dollars in ARR. They have these deals with labels. How long is it going to be before we see any kind of compensation or kind of residual income from that? I think that's still a huge open question. I think just by nature of how the AI landscape is evolving, for sure, it's like mostly within the platforms. The major rights holders, because they see the writing on the wall about like how these platforms will continue to improve and evolve and influence the market over time, are racing to do these deals. And because it's major music companies more than like indie labels that are doing these partnerships, that might, you know, accrue more influence to them. And then certainly not individual artists, I would say, in terms of where power is concentrating. There are certain AI artists that are generating pretty good income. Like there's a website called sloptracker.com, I think, that tracks the top 50 AI artists. And I think they're generating collectively hundreds of thousands of dollars every day or every week. And if you do the math, that's I think it's hundreds of thousands of dollars every month. So per artist, I think that's like a pretty good middle class income. So the top AI artists have already gotten to that state in terms of
middle class income, but upper class streaming income.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're in rarefied air if you're making tens of thousands of dollars a month, you know, from your streaming royalties.
Here's a question that I have for both of you, especially in view of where I spend most of my time, and Sherry, where you spend at least some of your time. And that is, should a 20-year-old artist be excited or worried
a few years ago, Sherry and I went to Drexel University, my alma mater, and we spoke. And a student came up to me afterwards and said, "So if you had one piece of advice for me, what would it be?" And ever since then, I've been giving the same piece of advice to people when I get this kind of similar question, which is throw parties. And what I mean by that is, if you can put people in a room, you will always have a business and you will have a pretty high chance of finding meaning in what you're doing, because I think there's something pretty special about that. And so, Larry, to your question, if I'm a 20-year-old artist and I am passionate about putting people in a room and creating some type of communal experience, I think this will only become more valuable and more appreciated. And I think you should be really, really excited. I promised I would, and I will go back to Matt Dryhurst one more time. This is a framework I can't claim, but I really, it's stuck with me more than anything else from that trip back in 2021, which is, recorded music is an anomaly. And it's only been around for 100+ years. And to say that we understand its role in our society and how it should be valued would be negligent is a word, but irresponsible. But to say we understand the role of live music and to understand the role of these communal meetings, getting together, singing together, playing music together, watching music, this I think we can be really confident of. And it's probably the thing I'm most confident in of all the predictions and things we like to talk about, is that live music and music as a shared experience is going nowhere. So I think in that regard, being a 20-year-old artist right now, I think is very, very thrilling. I think if you like exploring weird sounds and you are a, like a pirate, music pirate, and you just want to dive in, I think it's also extremely exciting because you are on the forefront of a technology that is really just blooming, and there's so much unexplored world. You know, it's truly like, Lewis and Clark, pre-Lewis and Clark. I would personally worry about being able to sustain a career as what I would say is this producer-songwriter type, which is what I did for my career. And I think people and artists are going to be able to do more and more on their own, and they probably will. And I'm not sure about that part of the business. And we talked about it earlier, Larry. So it's not all rosy for me, but I think there are things to be very excited about and things to be hesitant about. I would position myself, if I could go back 20 years, I would maybe, if I knew what was coming, I would position myself probably more towards the live experience.
So this was not my original intention to bring just a tiny bit of like political context into this, but I recently came across an article written by this electronic music producer named Drew Daniel, who makes more like electronic dance music under the moniker The Soft Pink Truth. And he had this really good article in The Quietus on creating art under fascism. And he, the general angle, like his specific opinion was the world is super crazy right now, and there's a lot of really troubling stuff that's happening globally. What is the purpose of me staying in my room making bleeps and bloops and turning knobs, what is the point of that? And I think that's probably a feeling that a lot of students feel right now, for sure. A lot of artists and creators feel right now, again, regardless of regardless of your political leanings or backgrounds, just like what is the purpose of art in this time, and can we make any kind of change? I say this all to, read out loud the last sentence of this article, which I think builds a lot onto everything that Young Spielberg said. Quote, "At its best, art reminds us of the possibility of freedom in this world, and the reality of our connection to each other as the basis and grounding condition of that freedom's expression," end quote. I thought that was just a really good ending to this feeling. And it's interesting, this article is like not fully conclusive. It doesn't give an answer, but I think it's very moving that it ends on this reminder about the power of art and also how the core of it is in human connection. So to bring it to, I guess, yeah, less political, philosophical, and more to like really practical advice, I 100% agree. Like, keep going out to events and like and hosting your own events, meeting with people, supporting small venues. Absolutely. I think one of the big debates that we haven't gotten into is what artist development looks like, right? Like, if once AI music floods the market, how will these artists who want to play shows get that experience and get above the noise? Like, who will be filling our stadiums and arenas in 10 to 15 years is such a fascinating question or debate.
Human artists, I presume.
We'll see. We'll see. It might be a hybrid, but for sure there are human artists who have a very important message to share and want to build a career around that. And I think that path will be really tough. And so as a supporter of music, that's going to become more and more important, I think, is to just go out and support artists, speak to them after the show, and really build like a community, not just with the artists, but with other fans who like to go out to shows, host your own party. Truly no party, no gathering is too small, in my opinion, you know, just like build that habit of meeting in person. And I think we are seeing a lot of like the younger generation move towards that direction anyway, which is good. And then the other, I guess, idea that I think would be good to keep in mind when talking about any kind of tech trend, I always like to say that the business world revolves around incentives. And as long as we are on this earth, it revolves around human incentives. So what this means for AI is that like AI alone, for now, again, as of recording this, but AI and technology in general has no incentives inherently. Human beings are wielding it, are using it to bring their own incentives to life. And so tech is actually just a mirror on like what we want to achieve in society. So to take certain common phrases like AI is taking our jobs, very, very common phrase that we hear in public discourse these days. I think a helpful, more specific read on that is it's not AI, it's human beings. It is executives who are making financially motivated decisions to lay people off, to restructure teams, to be more efficient and perform better as a company. That is a human decision. Similarly, even like AI is flooding the market. AI is not autonomously uploading itself to DistroKid or whatever other distributor and like flooding the market. These are real human decisions. It's like humans who are pressing the button on Suno or Udio or, you know, insert AI model here. And they're seeing that the current streaming ecosystem is like very easily gameable. And they're like, oh, how do I maximize my earnings from this? And so that's a very human decision to make. So I think the most important thing that as a student you can think about, you know, before you enter the workforce, before you, or maybe you're already thinking about, you know, how do I make my mark on this world, is like what drives me and what tools will help me kind of achieve that goal or this vision that I have. It may end up at something that Young was saying earlier, which is that like you don't use AI. And that's totally cool. That's great. You know, I think also we should avoid thinking that like, you know, AI in terms of its existence in society, where, you know, we're already here, but you don't have to be like an AI first, super gung-ho AI person by any means. Like, think critically always about, yeah, what are your own incentives? What are you trying to achieve? And then critically looking at what tools will help you get there. And, you know, also like staying wary of, you know, what other companies are doing, what their incentives are. And maybe that means that you should maybe not partner or align with them, or maybe that would be a really good job opportunity. So I think just that incentive human first framing, always remembering it's like humans who make these decisions. Hopefully, as a student, that's more reassuring and that you make the decision about how to use these tools at the end of the day.
Yeah. And look, I think really talented people and creation rises to the top. And to Sherry's point, you know, you reminded me, I have two friends in Philly. They go by Eraserhood Sounds, and they are retro specialists. They took over Questlove's record room, and they put a studio in it. And they have spent their entire lives recreating authentic 70s studios and learning how to play the instruments and studying that material. And one of them was the touring bassist for Lee Fields. And their careers are great, you know, and people go to them for that thing because that's what they do. And it has nothing to do with AI. And we talk about it all the time because we're friends and, you know, they're up on what's going on. But it just has nothing to do with what they're interested in doing in their area of expertise. So, you know, there are no rules. And I think there's opportunity out there for everybody.
Let's leave it there. And so on this episode, we've set the stage and mapped the current landscape and looked at where the tools are that actually work and started to get at some of the harder questions about who benefits and who bears the costs. On the next episode, we'll get into the money and the law regarding music and AI. Who gets paid, how that's changing, and what the legal and policy architecture is that's being built right now and what that actually means for creators and rights holders. And so, Sherry Hu and Young Spielberg from Water and Music, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.